This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. If you're looking for a strategic mind game of the first order with real-world implications to boggle the biggest brainiac, here it is, Iran and nuclear weapons. Iran denies and denies and moves forward. Last week, it broke the locks on uranium processing facilities and broke the backs of even European patients. An Iranian bomb would shadow the world's biggest oil fields and Israel, which its leaders denounce, and any place that terror can reach. But Russia sells Iran nuclear tech, China buys its oil, Europe wants a special friend, and the U.S. is stretched to the limit in Iraq and Afghanistan. Up next on Point, how Iran sees the nuclear game board. I want to turn now to New York City and Gary Sick. He is professor of Middle East policy at Columbia University. Gary Sick served on the National Security Council under Presidents Ford, Carter, and Reagan. He was principal White House aide on Iran during the Iranian Revolution and the U.S. hostage crisis there. Gary Sick, thank you very much for being with us today.
It's a pleasure.
So how serious is this path? Here we are again, locks broken, even Europeans this time kind of at the end of their rope. Iran now saying it wants more talks and Europe saying no. Does it seem to you that Iran is on the path to nuclear armed state, to nuclear weapons?
There really is no question in my mind that Iran is determined to get a full nuclear fuel cycle, that is, including enrichment, that would give it then the capacity at some point in the future to make a decision if it wanted to go for a weapon. I don't believe personally, and I don't believe that the evidence really shows that Iran is secretly building a bomb right now. What it is doing is developing its nuclear capabilities. And the problem with trying to stop that is that there are many, many countries in the world. The director of the IAEA says that there are 40 countries in the world that have the technical know-how to make a bomb in relatively short order. And Iran is saying, look, why can't we be part of that group, since almost everybody else in the world can do it?
Is that a mortal threat to the region, to Israel, to the United States and Europe, or is it a reasonable assertion on Iran's part?
Well, from the Iranian perspective, they certainly see this as a reasonable demand and one that is fully within their rights as signatories of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which a technical reading of the treaty would say that that's true. The problem with it is that nobody in the world trusts Iran these days, and that has to do with their history because of the revolution, because of the hostage crisis, because of a number of other issues that have come up, and most recently, of course, the election of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad as the president of Iran, whose incredible statements, one day after another, have simply taken Iran back to the old days of the 1980s when they were looked on as a fanatic country completely out of control.
The new president talking about wiping Israel off the map. Israel has responded in the past to Iraq on the nuclear advance front. Do you see the option out there, the military option, either from Israel or the United States? President Bush has pointedly not taken it off the table. Is it really there?
My own personal view of this is that we're not at all close to a nuclear option, to a military option at this point. The military option, the more you look at it, the worse it looks. Basically, right now, we have a number of good things going for us. We don't pay any attention to that, but there are more IAEA inspectors in Iran today than in any other country in the world. When Iran went to lift the seals, those seals were put there by the IAEA, mm-hmm. and they were there to supervise the process. If we should bomb Iran or take some military action, or any country might, I think it's very clear that those inspectors would get thrown out. That would be one of the very first things that would happen, and that would be a huge loss.
Let's listen back just for a moment to February. A year ago, President Bush at a meeting of EU leaders saying, no, we won't strike, but not ruling out the possibility.
And finally, this notion that the United States is getting ready to attack Iran is simply ridiculous. Having said that, all options are on the table.
Having said that, says the President of the United States, I'm joined now in the studio as well by Geev Mir Federensky. He is a columnist and news analyst for the BBC's Persian News Service, author of a diplomatic history of the Caspian Sea, former professor of international law at Tufts Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy and at Brandeis University, born and raised Iranian. Geev, thanks very much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Take us into the outlook of Iranians. And here we're told not just the kind of bombastic new president, but all kinds of Iranians who say we want and deserve nuclear power, even nuclear weapons. Why?
Well, there are two aspects to this thing. First thing is it's more or less a cultural perspective that the Iranians have by and large, regardless of what political stripe they belong to. And you can include in that the secular nationalists, you can include in that the fundamentalists, the Islamists, and whatnot. And, mm-hmm. and the point basically goes to this, that a very large component of the great civilization on the threshold of which Iran was supposed to stand in the year 2000 mm-hmm. had the Shah survived his time.
This was the picture painted by the Shah. We're headed toward global greatness.
Exactly. Had a very viable component about nuclear energy in it.
Why? Iran is oil rich.
That is true. It is also oil poor in a sense that it has to bring its refined products from abroad. It also rather sell this product instead of burning it up as a part of electric generation.
But nuclear weapons are such a charged issue, nuclear power in general. Why not build its oil refineries instead of nuclear uranium enrichment plants?
Because there's more profit to be made by selling the oil downstream as opposed to burning it for fuel inside Iran. And it's not a very infinite resource either. It will finish at one time. That blueprint was put in place back in the early 70s. And what the Iranian leadership at the moment is pursuing is basically going for nuclear energy as a matter of not only economic priority and energy priority for the country, but also is looking at it as a matter of technical advancement, science, and prestige. There is a psychological component to this, which I'm afraid is fueling a lot more than it ought to. In the long term, I don't think it's viable for the Iranians to be importing, to be making their own nuclear fuel when they can be importing it a lot cheaper from abroad. Provided there's a supply out there for them.
But there's the vision of Iran as a kind of global player. There's nationalism at stake here. Also, its own security concerns. Gary Sick, is there a credible Iranian case for nuclear power for the full nuclear fuel cycle close to weaponry as you describe it? Or is that, on the face of it, somehow out of bounds, wrong, unacceptable?
Well, part of this comes from the fact that Iran went through the Iran-Iraq War when they were struck by chemical weapons from Saddam Hussein's Iraq. And at that time, there were international instruments in place that said that Iraq was not supposed to do that and the world community was supposed to intervene. In the fact, they didn't. And Iran found itself alone. So part of their feeling is that they must have a guaranteed source of fuel for their nuclear reactors if they are going to survive, because they know in the future that one country or another, despite what promises it makes today, may change their mind. Now, that comes from a very deep-seated sense of, first of all, Iranian pride and determination to develop as a modern nation, but it also comes from a very deep paranoia that Iran has no friends. And, of course, in that sense, they have a very good case to be made.
But can the world, can the world, Gary Sick, will the world accept this, the sort of inexorable move toward nuclear weapons there? Can it? Will it?
Well, I mean, you keep saying that, they're moving toward a bomb. I really think it is important to make the case that they are moving, that they are developing a capability which would in the future, maybe quite a long time in the future, mm-hmm. give them the capacity to build a bomb. But as I say, there are like 40 other countries in the world that have that capacity today. And what I think should be the logical outcome of this thing is that Iran gets a certain token amount of enrichment to salve its national pride. And
that is homegrown enrichment that it could do itself and therefore
right.
feel independent there.
But it comes with intense inspection and control over every aspect of that. So that One, if it is kept small, and two, it is very intensively monitored. Two things are true. First of all, if Iran should then decide that it wants to actually build a bomb, one, we would know it immediately, because as soon as they started higher level enrichment, it would become obvious. And secondly, we would then have quite a long time, a time lapse of, it could be 5 years, to react to that. That, it seems to me, although it's far from perfect, and I think a lot of countries are rightfully nervous about the fact that Iran would have this technical capability to build a bomb. The other side is that if we go in with military force or something of the sort, we will, in fact, force them to do exactly what we don't want them to do.
That is?
They'll get rid of the inspectors, they'll go underground, and they'll build a bomb. And I think that is something, and we're going to find it very, very difficult to stop that. So from my point of view, coming to an agreement that severely limits both the amount of enrichment that they do and the controls on that enrichment is not a perfect solution, but it's better than what I see as the alternative.
And yet, so far, every agreement or near agreement seems to lead to some kind of, you know, a step forward, two steps back. Aviv Mir-Fenderesky, what about, look at this from Israel's perspective for a second. You see the statements made by the Iranian president very recently saying it might be better off without Israel. Of course, nuclear weapons are one way of literally accomplishing that. Can Israel accept an Iranian nuclear advance? Is it, in this language, as threatened as it might well fear?
Well, a part of nuclearization of the Iranian military also requires a certain amount of education, re-education in doctrines of nuclear parity, one of which is basically that if your adversary has a second strike capability, it will wipe you off the face of the map as well. So in that sense, it seems to me that to have looked at this simply from the point of view on offense on the Iranian side and not putting enough value on the deterrence value of nuclear weapons for Iran, should it go that way, also invites the same kind of an analysis from the Israeli point of view. But historically, we don't need to mince words here. The Iranian position at the time of the creation of the State of Israel was in the minority, and there were three, four countries that basically had aspired to a unitary state as opposed to a two-state solution for Israel. And what President Ahmadinejad may be harking back to is the simplicity of the solution that Iran had put forth at that time, including a lot of other countries with substantial Muslim populations, incidentally, and to allow for a state of Israel that basically has where the Arabs and Jews coexist together in one kind of a unitary system. We have basically have abandoned that project. We are in a two-state proposal right now. And what he's saying, I'm not sure whether he's basically making an anti-Israel as a country statement or is he making an anti-Jewish statement. I'm kind of not exactly clear as to what does he mean precisely, but what he's saying, other than to basically fuel a lot of paranoia that exists on the other side of the fence in Tel Aviv as well, that these guys, if they have the nuclear capability, they're going to attack us.
Mm-hmm. Gary Sick, Iran's president could hardly be more clear at some rhetorical level. Iran's support for Hezbollah has been very steady over many years. Look at this from Israel's point of view for a moment. What's the red line here, a step-too-far line in Iranian nuclear capacity development?
Well, actually, the United States and Israel have been on pretty much the same page all the way through. And 10 years ago, started with a policy that Iran should have no access to nuclear technology at all, and that included nuclear power plants. Over the years, we've decided that there's no way that we can stop them from getting nuclear power plants, especially since the Russians agreed to assist. And we've changed our position. The Israelis and the Americans have changed their position. And I think what we're doing is slowly adjusting to reality. I am not in favor of Iran getting a bomb. I think that that would be a mistake, and I think it would be terrible. I think there are ways available to the international community to keep Iran from getting a bomb. And that part of this involves the kind of what I see as a lot of posturing going on, both by Iran in terms of its negotiating tactics and in our side. We're holding out threats of taking them to the Security Council, when in fact the threat of getting there is probably worse than getting there, because once we arrive at the Security Council, it's going to be difficult to figure out what we do.
Is the United States hamstrung by its being strapped in Iraq and Afghanistan? Does the U.S. have real options?
Well, this is part of the problem, that it's very difficult to believe that the United States is going to launch another military campaign in the Middle East right now, given the political and military situation that we're in with regard to Iraq. And, of course, Iran's, you know, help in Iraq is actually quite useful to us. The whole business about the Shia south of Iraq being under control and being relatively quiet has a large part to do with Iran's policies. So we're sort of caught up in a set of dilemmas.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, the pushing and shoving that are going on, although they scare people and they arouse strong emotions, in reality, I think there's some really serious negotiating going on here, and that the U.S. government does mean what it says when it says that, in fact, this can be resolved by negotiation. They mean that, and I think we're going to see more negotiating before this is over.
We can all hope that that works out, but you say if they did get nuclear weapons, it would be terrible. Exactly what do you mean by that? Exactly, give us a sort of strategic view of why that would be terrible.
Well, first of all, you ask us to think about what it would look like from Iran. I think that if Iran decided to go for a bomb and actually said that it had one, the level of international opposition to Iran would go up. Their ability to deal with other countries would be severely affected. It is true that if they suddenly were discovered to have a bomb, that would give them additional deterrence capability to convince other people not to mess with them. But at the same time, it would also provide a huge incentive for people to intervene and stop them before they could possibly use it. And I think a lot of Iranians really understand that. There is a big difference between the Iranians who feel that they want nuclear technology like other major countries in the world, and they see themselves as a major power, between those people and the people who say we should have a nuclear weapon. Those people are much smaller, much fewer, and much less vocal in many respects.
I want to bring another voice, if I may, into this conversation. Gary Sick, Givmir Federensky, from Washington. We're joined by Kenneth Pollack. He's director of research at the Brookings Institution Saban Center for Middle East Policy, author of The Persian Policy, The Conflict Between Iran and America, former official in the National Security Council and the CIA. Kenneth Pollack, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to be in such an erudite conversation.
So we've got a tremendous game of brinksmanship going on here. Who's playing better? Who's winning?
Tough to say right now. Honestly, I don't think either side is particularly winning. You can certainly make the case that the Iranians have not been blocked in trying to move forward with their nuclear program. They've restarted conversion. They've broken the seals on the Natanz enrichment facility.
Mm-hmm.
But by the same token, they are increasingly alienated. They are increasingly isolated. They're not in a very good diplomatic position. And I think it's unclear whether they're going to be willing to sustain these programs in the face of this kind of international opposition, although that, of course, will be dependent on what the rest of the world does. As far as the United States and Europe are concerned, there has been some success in the sense that the U.S. and Europe have made clear that what Iran is doing is beyond the pale, and they have gotten a great deal of international support for that position. Another notable achievement that the Bush administration is touting, and it's not inconsequential, is the fact that you now finally have the Americans and the Europeans working off the same sheet of music, very much in lockstep, at least so far, as to what the policy toward Iraq would be. And given the dissonance that we saw in our Iran policies in the 1990s, that is actually a major achievement. But by the same token, the West has not accomplished its goals either. The Iranians are moving forward with their programs, and we've not yet seen any willingness on the part of even the Europeans to really put meaningful pressure on the table, meaningful economic sanctions, or other forms of pressure that might actually change Iranian thinking and cause them to shift direction.
Iran has said, if you do that, we have our own leverage. We can close down the Straits of Hormuz. We can close down the oil flow to the West. How much leverage against pressure does Iran have, Kenneth Pollack?
Well, I would put it this way. First, I think those kind of extreme threats that you're hearing from President Ahmadinejad are really quite irrelevant to this discussion. They're actually kind of ridiculous threats that I can't imagine any sensible policymaker in Tehran wanting to espouse. And the fact that Ahmadinejad makes statements and people around him make statements like that really goes to the naivete of this new government in Tehran. But we ought to remember that Ahmadinejad and the people around him are not fully in control in Iran. Point of fact, there are other figures out there with much greater power, much greater persuasiveness in the Iranian regime. Typically, what we've seen from them is a much more reasonable, albeit still very anti-status quo approach.
Gary Sick, let's just be very clear about this. Is there a real military option here? Could Israel do something about this as it did in Iran? Could the U.S., or is that not a realistic option?
Well, I must say that the people who have looked at this, and Ken Pollack is one of the people who has looked at it very closely, I think have concluded that it stretches Israel's capabilities absolutely to the max, and that they could strike Iran, but they would be almost suicide missions. And Iran has scattered its nuclear sites out over a large territory and has put many of them underground, so that you can't just go out, do one strike, and figure that's it. It's not that kind of an operation. You need to be able to keep doing it. So basically what would happen if Israel decided to act on its own is that everybody in the world would believe that the United States was party to that, that we approved it and we agreed to do it, and that we would be held responsible for it, and I think we would be the ones who would have to then follow up one way or the other. So from my point of view, and the other thing is, wherever you start the military operation, however low-level, cruise missiles or even sabotage, if you really play the game out and see what happens, at the end of the day, if Iran goes underground and says, all right, everybody out, all the inspectors gone, we're going to go for a bomb, we're going to leave the non-proliferation treaty, and we're going underground and building a bomb, and you can't stop us, then there's only one real solution to that. I mean, you can keep bombing if you like, but to really stop them, you've got to put troops on the ground. So basically, it seems to me that the momentum of the thing is that if you start a military action, you've got to be prepared to go to an invasion. And that is a very, very unpleasant option for any country in the world, and certainly for the United States right now.
Kenneth Pollack, do you believe Israel sees it the way Gary Sicks just lined it out?
Absolutely. As Gary pointed out, I've spent a lot of time working through this problem. I'm a former military analyst at CIA, and as part of that, I actually had any number of conversations with Israeli military and intelligence officers, and it's very clear to me that the Israelis understand exactly what Gary laid out. They have a very simple problem. Iran is too far away from Israel. They have a very capable air force, but they simply do not have the numbers of long-range aircraft that would allow them to strike at these various Iranian targets, as Gary pointed out, some of them very difficult to destroy from the distance that they would have to travel. And as a result, the Israelis seem to understand that if there is going to be a solution to the problem of Iran's pursuit of a nuclear weapons capability, it's going to have to be one that is engineered by the United States and the international community. And I'd simply add that I think that's one of the most important reasons. In fact, I think it is the principal reason that you are hearing Israel making so much noise about their concern about Iran. For those of your listeners who remember it, before 1981, before the Israeli attack on the Iraqi nuclear facility of Sirak, we didn't hear a word from the Israelis about the Iraqi program. It was not until Sirak was a smoking ruin that the Israelis said anything. And I think it's very clear that the Israelis understand that they really don't have a good military option, and that's why they are trying to put it first and foremost before the international community, to get the international community to take on this problem.
Does that mean no one has a good military option? I mean, not that a military option would ever be good, but does the United States, is it in the same camp? Can Iran make its life in Iraq miserable, untenable, just to put another piece in here?
Yeah, no, that's actually a very important point, Tom, which is we obviously have military capabilities that the Israelis don't. We have an enormous air force. We have bases and carriers that can set up right on Iran's doorstep. We can run much bigger air operations than the Israelis can, and if we ever chose to do so, we could obliterate much of Iran's nuclear program. That said, there are a bunch of real disincentives there. First, there is the fact that, as Gary pointed out, this would mean war with Iran. It would be the end of the inspections regime. It would be the end of the NPT control over Iran's nuclear program. We might set them back for some years, but we would have to expect that at some point in the future they would get a nuclear weapon. Second, as I said, it would mean war with Iran, and the Iranians would not take this lying down. They do have very formidable terrorist capabilities, and we would have to expect that they would strike back at us. And as you're pointing out, Tom, and as Gary said earlier, one of the areas where the Iranians have already made clear that they would strike back at us is in Iraq. They have a tremendous capacity to inflict violence on us in Iraq, and so far they have not done so. Again, as Gary pointed out, they have generally been more helpful to us than hurtful in Iraq, and helpful in some very important ways. And we would have to ask ourselves, are we ready to jeopardize the reconstruction of Iraq, which is already deeply troubled, and begin a clandestine war with Iran in Iraq to set back their nuclear program, possibly by only 2 or 3 years, depending on various estimates of how far along the Iranians already are?
That sounds awfully daunting. Give Mir Fenderesky, what about it? I mean, there are a lot of American troops on almost all sides of Iran at this point. Well, does Iran feel that its national security is threatened? Well, I mean, and why? What interest would the U.S. have in going into Iran shy of a nuclear weapon? As we've heard, the U.S. kind of needs their tacit support in Iraq. The U.S. has enough on its hands. Does it really feel threatened by the U.S.?
It's a very good point that the caller is making. Essentially, if I may put it in kind of terms that the listeners can understand, in terms of United States anxiety at one point with respect to Cuba, some of the aircraft carriers that are operating in the Persian Gulf today, not to mention the tens and hundreds of thousands of troops scattered all around, are closer to the Iranian mainland than Cuba was to Florida at the time of the missile crisis.
And we have Condoleezza Rice saying the Iranians deserve better. That is, they deserve a better government. There always seems like a kind of decapitation threat or encouragement out there.
This is essentially at the core of the Iranian paranoia as expressed by Ahmadinejad. When he's asking for the West to understand the Iranian nation and the revolution, he's basically sending a message saying, we are still in the throes of trying to become legitimate here. And from day one, we've been looking over our shoulders largely because of two fears. A, there's constant drumbeat of regime change, which makes us very, very scared. And secondly, this talk about dismembering Iran, undermining its territorial integrity. Because
who talks about that?
Well, there are circles in the United States and some places in Europe, some intellectuals, some policy circles, as a part of the whole description of the remapping the Middle East. The pieces of that have to do with Azerbaijan. A piece has to do with Kurdistan. A piece has to do with Balochistan. So this sense of paranoia that we are not only encircled by adversaries all around us is this notion that the very disappearance of the Iranian state is at stake. And so if there is a paranoia in Tehran, I think it's largely fueled by this sense that we don't know if we're going to survive here or not. And that's why I don't think they see this crisis the way the West sees it. They simply see it as a process of coming to that ultimate goal, which is to be recognized as a legitimate government, a legitimate country with legitimate aspirations, with guarantees that it won't be attacked and brought under, just as the North Koreans are requesting of the United States and the Group of Six to assure them.
Gary Sick, this raises the fundamental issue of whether there's an essential conflict between the United States and Iran here. Is this negotiable, or is there something in the basic motivations of these two countries that puts them on a collision course?
They certainly have very different interests, and there's no question about that. The United States has a set of interests that certainly first want to protect Israel, but also want to prevent the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction in the hands of countries that we don't trust. On Iran's side, you have a country that I think is absolutely determined to go ahead with nuclear technology. And the question really is, how much are you willing to pay for that? I personally went through a process when the Iranian hostage crisis was held, where you had a superpower on one side, the United States, and Iran on the other, that was in the middle of revolutionary fervor, and they were prepared to to literally die, all of them, to protect their country and to protect their revolution. That's very hard to deal with. Take it from me that in terms of negotiating, if you have a country that is prepared to ultimately almost commit suicide, it gets very, very difficult.
But is Iran still in that state of mind, or
well,
its leadership?
I don't think so, but I do believe that they are prepared to pay a lot in order to get this. That even if you talk to the Iranian expatriates in Los Angeles and various other things, they disagree with the mullahs completely. They disagree with Ahmadinejad. They treat him as a point of foolishness. But they believe that Iran should have nuclear technology. And that is something that goes very much to the heart of the issue. And so from my perspective, if you can give Iran what it feels it must have, but keep that under control so that, in fact, that capability of a full nuclear fuel cycle is not used to produce a bomb, that, to me, is the best outcome.
Now,
not easy to do, and I don't guarantee it. But I do think that as an objective, that's a pretty good place to start.
Let them get closer, but not go all the way. Kenneth Pollack, we've just got a minute left here. We've barely touched on the terror piece. Iran has sponsored Hezbollah. I mean, of course, the deepest fear here is of nuclear weapons that would get into a kind of terror back channel, which didn't even respond to traditional deterrence.
I know that that is a fear, and it is one that the administration has tried out from time to time. I see very little evidence of concern of that. I want to be careful here. Mm-hmm. Like Gary, I would really prefer that the world not have to deal with a nuclear weapon-armed Iran. I think we would be far better off not to have to deal with that. But that said, on the terrorism threat front, we've not seen any evidence that the Iranians would give these weapons to terrorists, and in fact, a lot of evidence that they wouldn't. Just very simply, Iran has been supporting terrorist groups for 26 years. They have had weapons of mass destruction in the form of chemical and probably biological weapons for about 16 years. They have never seen fit to mix the two.
Kenneth Pollack at the Brookings Institution, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Gary Sick at Columbia University. Gary, thank you for joining us this hour.
It was a pleasure to be with you.
And Giv Mir Fendereski, thanks so much for joining us. Great to have you in studio.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.